I kind of watch all of her facial muscles soften and her eyes get real big. And like, she kind of went nonverbal. It was, I mean, I had a child part with me.
Hey everyone, welcome to Therapeutic Perspective. I'm Lisa Sauvignon, your host. This podcast is for mental health providers and grad students looking for real tools and techniques for clinical skill building and practice growth. We take an honest look at the methods and challenges of building a practice, developing clinical skills, side hustles, and second businesses, the fun side of being a therapist, and doing all of this while managing everything else that life has in store for us. So let's get started. Welcome, everyone. Today's guest is Dr. Jessica Endress, and we're going to discuss dissociation, childhood trauma, and dissociative identity disorder, or DID. This is part one of a two-part episode, so feel free to jump right into the next episode, episode 59, or take a break in between, whatever works for you. Our guest, Dr. Endress, shares so much information, not just about working with trauma survivors, but also how dissociation can show up in other diagnoses, including ADHD, OCD, and even eating disorders. We also discuss the treatment process in detail, look at common assessments and questionnaires, dive into the myths of working with this population, and discuss how DID may not present in quite the way you think it does. This really is something every clinician needs to know about, so get ready for two really great episodes. Well, welcome to Therapeutic Perspective. And Dr. Endress, if you just want to start by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, I'm Dr. Jessica Endress. I'm a licensed professional counselor in Texas, and I offer like virtual counseling services, consultation for other counselors who are wanting to work with trauma and dissociation or dissociative disorders. And then I'm also a counselor educator. So I teach adjunct as a professor at a couple of universities in the DFW area. And yeah, I love getting to do a little bit of everything. I went to Texas A&M for my undergrad. So I always start all of my emails out with howdy, and it's just like an annoying little factor that I'm always going to hold on to. And then I did both my graduate degrees, my master's and my doctorate at Sam Houston State University down in Huntsville, just a bit outside of Houston. And yeah, finished my master's degree, went out in the world, got some experience, and then decided, hey, this is good timing. I will go back and do the doctorate. And yeah, it's been great since then. In that time, I also got trained in EMDR. So I've got the basic trainings, and then I've done some advanced trainings with Dr. Nacho Herrero. He's a clinician out of Mexico, and him and his wife both do EMDR and all sorts of stuff. So they do have like group protocols and things like that that I've worked with. And then now I'm certified in DBT and I'm certified in trauma model therapy. Which is not often one that people know about. So if anyone is interested in that, it is a theoretical approach developed by Dr. Colin Ross. And there's a heavy focus on trauma-informed care and how to help clients with dissociative disorders. So that is one that people may want to look into. But that's kind of a big thing for me. And then in general, I also really like Adlerian therapy. And I feel like it's very like flexible for how I conceptualize clients and can kind of work with them. And so I blend that heavily with trauma model therapy. And then of course, like taking a more inclusive perspective as well for my dissociative clients, like fit into all of that. And then also like my LGBT clients and things like that as well. So that I can kind of, you know, everybody can fit into that theoretical approach.
So I'll just go ahead and dive in here. But I want to start with just, you know, mentioning that there has been an increased presentation of dissociative symptoms, you know, DID and dissociative disorders as well. And I don't know if that's necessarily an increase in presentation or an increase in awareness. But because it's an area that I am passionate about, like you said, we both work with very similar populations. When we discussed this episode, you know, one of the things that you mentioned to me is that you wanted to explain the difference between dissociation as a symptom and dissociative disorders. So now here at the beginning seems like a great place to do that. So I'll let you go ahead and start with that.
Yeah. So I'll be talking a lot about DID, right? Dissociative identity disorder. But I like to explain kind of the difference between the words dissociation, dissociative disorder, and DID, right? Because you'll see them like used interchangeably a lot, even in the research. which makes it even more confusing. But dissociation is a symptom, and we see that in a lot of different disorders. So even disorders like ADHD, they have a lot of absorption is a type of dissociation, right? Where they can get very hyperfixated on things, or they can get kind of lost in their own mind. Similar symptom we see in something like DID, but clearly it's very different, you know, diagnosis and issue going on with different treatment. Dissociative disorder can refer to a lot of different disorders, right? So in the DSM-5, we get five dissociative disorders. We have DID, we have dissociative amnesia, depersonalization, derealization disorder, otherwise specified dissociative disorder, OSDD. And you'll hear me mention that quite a bit because DID and OSDD are kind of a difference in severity versus totally different diagnoses. So they go very hand in hand. And then you have just your unspecified dissociative disorder. If you're using ICD-11, you have those five and four more, where you also get dissociative neurological symptom disorder, where it's more related to neurological concerns on the medical side, trance disorder, possession trance disorder, and partial DID. So when we say dissociative disorder, like we could mean any of those, right? So that's like nine different options, right? But colloquially, most people, when they say dissociative disorder or dissociation, they might be meaning DID, right? Mm-hmm. And so I always try to like clarify the language because, you know, as clinicians, as counselors, like we should kind of know the difference, and also being able to talk about dissociation in your clients when they may not have a dissociative disorder and they may not be DID and they can still have dissociation that we still want to treat. My biggest hope and goal is like, even if people don't want to like work with dissociative disorders or like DID or whatever, that like they understand dissociation is a symptom and like how to assess it, what tools we have for that, which one of our main tools is our dissociative experience scale, which is the DES-2, second revision. And they also have a DES for adolescents and children as well. And those really help us evaluate like what is my client experiencing, their experiences of this symptom. And it guides us in how we can treat them and help them, right? Now, it can also guide us to see, is this more dissociative disorder or is this like ADHD? OCD, right. OCD, there's a lot of dissociation, autism. I mean, like there's so many different things where there can be dissociation, but it may not be a dissociative disorder. So I think everybody needs to know about the symptom, just like we need to know about depression and anxiety. So I think in general, I think every counselor should know a little bit about dissociation as a symptom, right? Just like we should know a little bit about depression, a little bit like about anxiety, but we may not like specialize in those disorders, right? I just choose to more specialize in the trauma and the dissociative disorders. And I kind of like fell into working with dissociative disorders, which is many people will tell you that. That's kind of how it happens a lot of the time. And I was working at a rape crisis center. I was helping people with trauma from, you know, sexual abuse, sexual assaults, all sorts of different, you know, abuses and violences there. And I get my first client that's like, I dissociate a lot. I don't know what's happening. I'm kind of freaked out. And I'm like, okay, like I've heard about this loosely in graduate school, but like, I don't really know what I'm doing. But I'm like, okay, you know, tell me about that. I'm just very open, right? Open-ended questions. And the more information that I get, I'm like, oh, okay, something's going on here. And I don't quite know what is going on. But there's a heavy, heavy trauma history. There's so much that these clients have been through, right? And so that's what really stood out to me the most of like, these are clients and this is a population that I don't think that it's, you know, super widespread. Our percentages are still pretty low when we do studies and things, but it is also a very, an underdiagnosed to an extent disorder because it's kind of set up to conceal itself, but the numbers are likely still, you know, lower. It's not something that everybody will have, even if you've experienced trauma, right? That doesn't always happen. But the people that have experienced this and they do meet criteria for this diagnosis, they need a lot of support. They need a lot of validation. They need to be seen. They need to be cared for and like not hurt. And they need patience. They need all these things from us. And I just see them not getting it. Every client I've worked with, there's only been a couple that I happen to be their first counselor. But most of them, they've been through 6, 7, 8 counselors, you know, and psychiatrists, and nobody knew what to do with the dissociation, or nobody believed them, or they didn't understand, you know, the parts and the switching and things like that. So they just didn't deal with it, you know, or maybe they didn't do harm, but they just didn't help the client. And so I really like getting to help people that I think get very, very marginalized in terms of clientele for counselors, right? When we look at that, like, I think they're kind of pushed to the edge. Like, we're trying to help all these people and help people with trauma, but I don't know about those people, right? People kind of push these clients kind of to the edge, and I don't like that. And I think that they deserve it. Just, you know, they deserve help and support just like anybody else. And they are very unlikely to have it in their lives already. And so counseling is the perfect space for that. But I just know that they don't get it all the time. And so that's where I fell into it, because I happened to have a client that was presenting with DID. And I just kind of saw like the need and felt like, this is where I want to be. And this is like who I want to be helping, because they're not getting help. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's also, I mean, shocking, some of the statistics that you look at too, of kind of overlap with other diagnoses, like, and other marginalizations as well. If we look at like intersectionality with race, with like neurodivergence, right? Like people with autism can have DID as well. You can have multiple diagnoses, right? We do know that. And people who are trans can also have DID. Like, you know, there's just so many intersectional ways how, you know, this group of people are marginalized. And I just really want to be somebody that's able to like see them and help them and like, you know, be a part of their journey.
Yes, absolutely. And I do understand what you're saying about just sort of stumbling into it. And then, you know, at first you're like, okay, what do I do with this? This is new to me.
Yeah.
And also seeing it co-occur. I do a lot of work with borderline personality disorder, PTSD, and see a lot of this in there as well. And like you, you know, you see that maybe they have been through a few counselors before you, and maybe it just wasn't the right fit for whatever reason. Yeah. And they come to you, and, you know, there's that moment where they're finally like, oh, I'm heard, I'm seen, the and it's exhale. So beautiful. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Getting the exhale when clients can like, like, you don't realize you've been holding your breath, right? Mm-hmm. And that's such a good feeling. And to be a part of that and help facilitate that is wonderful.
Oh, yes.
I think, too, you're kind of hitting on, too, it's making me think of how a big reason, too, I went back for the doctorate was, like, to try to help people, like, in this area I was, like, starting to specialize in. And when I got this first client, I go to my supervisor, right? Because I was a new counselor, right? At the time we were interns. And I'm like, hey, I'm just an intern. I don't know what I'm doing. Like, help. And she's like, I can help you all day long with like the domestic violence stuff and the sexual assault stuff and like working around that and tolerating that. But like, I don't know that much about the dissociative stuff. Like, a little bit as a symptom, but like, I don't know about dissociative disorders. And so she really just encouraged me to reach back out to one of my old professors who had been my trauma and crisis and trauma professor, Dr. Lawson, and was like, you got to reach out to him and ask him, like, what do we do? And so he later ended up being like kind of my mentor. And when I went back for my doctorate and was chair of my dissertation, and he was so great. And I was just like, hey, do you remember me? I really need your help. And he was so kind about it. And he was like, just listening. And I was like, I think this might be what's going on, but like, I don't really know. And he was like, well, Jessica, I think you might have your first DID client. And just know it might be kind of a lifelong commitment, you know, like you've really got to invest in the relationship with these clients, and you probably won't see them, you know, weekly forever. You'll have periods of time where they'll be on their own, and that will be great, but they'll come back to you when they need you. And just already preparing me at the very beginning of like what's needed for these clients long term is relationship, safe base, someone to come back to. And very often it's not likely to be their families. Very often that is the source of an issue for them and a part of the trauma. Not always, but often. And so they need the external person, right, that can be consistent and be there for them. And I was so glad to get that advice very early on in my career, in working with DID clients, because I kind of knew going in, okay, like if I'm not going to refer this client, like, I'm going to stick with them, you know, and just kind of making that commitment. And that can be kind of hard too, because obviously we change jobs and stuff changes and people retire at some point, but to the biggest extent that we can, really committing to these clients is really, really important.
Yes. And I think committing, recognizing the need for commitment and committing to it is a big thing for a lot of us, because, you know, we go in, I know I went into it with, these are my timelines. This is typically how long it takes me to complete EMDR from beginning to end. And I would definitely now say I'm a long-term provider. I understand that this may be, you know, 18 months, 2 years, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. I, like you, I've learned that it's important that we're there, that we are present, mm-hmm. that we're safety, that we're the one that's willing to accept and listen and allow them to get what they need and provide that validation time and time again, and we will always be there. And I describe it as modeling a healthy relationship beginning to end. And, you know, the piece that you talked about in particular, where they may go away but come back, you know, that object permanence is a big thing. And that's even a conversation I have in session, because I let them know, hey, we're modeling a healthy relationship. This is what a healthy relationship looks like. And even learning that I'm going to be here no matter what, 2 weeks from now, a month from now, 6 months from now, I'm still here is a big part of that. So I'm right there with you.
It's a huge part, right? And I feel like you do, like, you understand this when you work with these clients that have such deep relational trauma and relational needs. Like you said, it's such a good model that therapy can be, but it looks very different than what is taught in graduate school, right? Where it's like, oh, you have this many sessions and then you terminate with the client. I tell my clients all the time, I don't really fully terminate. I end with people where I'm like, hey, I feel like you've been doing well, and I've been kind of watching it the last couple of times. And like, I'm wondering, like, do you feel that? Is that something that maybe you feel ready for us to meet less often? And I just slowly wean them off until they feel ready. Mm-hmm. And then I always let them know, like, hey, I'm not just like done with you, right? Like, if you need me, as long as I'm like legally able to see you, you know, for like the state licensing laws, virtual telehealth is wonderful and way more accessible, so we can see each other again. And that's been very, very helpful with a lot of my clients. And I've had some clients reach out and find me from other jobs before I was in private practice, where, you know, they just Google me and they find me. And, you know, that's great. We'll pick right up where we need to.
I think knowing that we're always there, we may be the only ones in their life that provide that. And it's such a wonderful experience for them to know I'm safe. Mm-hmm. This person is always here for me. They're not going to judge me. And I can return at any time for as much or as little as needed.
Exactly. And I do find too that sometimes people ask me, they're like, well, don't people like take advantage of that, quote unquote? And I'm like, no, they don't. Like, they want to be on their own. And for as long as they can be on their own, like, they will.
Yes.
But if they need me, if things change, I want them to know I'm here. Right. And I don't really struggle with issues with boundaries with them. You know, I find especially my DID and trauma clients to be just very, very respectful and very kind towards me of like, you know, if I happen to respond to something, you know, a message on the weekend, they're like, you know, hey, it's your weekend or something, you know, and like very aware of that. And I usually hold my boundaries with that in general. But I mean, they don't push them. And so I don't think it becomes an ethical issue at all. It becomes like, when we're working towards goals and we get there, cool, be on your own for a little while. But when we have new goals and things change, I'm right here.
Come on back. I'm here for you. Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And I know we're going to cover myths, so I don't want to get ahead too far. Sure. But it's not that it's a myth, but I hear from some providers that working with this population, boundaries are a huge issue. And I like, I don't have that problem. I mean, I really, I think the relationship and the validation and the safety within session is what's needed. And when that's provided, it allows them to be okay. I'm okay when I'm not with you.
Right. Right. And it's structure that you come in with, right? You know, I come in with the structure for my clients of like, I do most of my correspondence via email because it's easier for me to remember and keep up with, you know, obviously anything important I'd go through my secure portal, but you know, just like scheduling. I don't do phone, right? Because I just, I mean, obviously, if I need to call someone, I will. But like, I try not to because, you know, I can lose track of time and I forget what I've said and blah, blah, blah. So it's a little easier if I just do email. And I set that up in the very beginning. I let them know. I let them know too, you know, like I'm not going to contact them outside of hours. And I stick to that myself. I think sometimes as counselors too, when we bend the rules, sometimes people are like, oh, okay, it's more flexible, you know, and things like that. And you know, they're used to other personal relationships versus professional relationship. And so it's normal to have to learn to do that. But I agree. I also work with clients who have borderline personality disorder as well. And that is a huge stigma against them as well for boundary issues. And when you provide the structure and you build the good relationship, you just don't tend to have a bunch of those issues. And, you know, if you do, you can navigate them pretty well, you know, and ends up being okay.
Yes, yes.
Not as scary.
No, it really isn't. And if it comes up, which I would say rarely, I mean, I'm trying to think, and honestly, I can't come up with one, but I know if I encounter that, handling it relationally goes incredibly well. That's, I mean, it's part of the relationship and it's a conversation we have and that's okay. And we move on.
Exactly.
Yep.
Exactly.
Yes. Yay. Look at us. We are like gelling. We've got this. I actually lost track of where I was for a second.
It's okay. And sorry. I think we were hitting lots of questions there.
Oh, yeah. It was great, though. I feel like you really covered, you know, why you're passionate about this work. I felt your passion. I so understand your passion on a very deep level. And we touched on a lot of the stigma and the beliefs around working with these clients. And so I'm curious, is there anything we didn't cover in terms of why you think this is important for other clinicians to know about?
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons I think it's very important to know about is in the same way, like you mentioned earlier, you know, we all kind of have our specialties and then there's things we know a little bit about, but we don't specialize in. So for me, that tends to be like ADHD and autism, right? Mm-hmm. Those are just not my specialties, but every once in a while I have a client who like, I think maybe they have some symptoms of one of those or like they think they do. And so I just acknowledge it. And I'm like, okay, let's kind of explore that together. You know, I let them know it's not my specialty, but let's explore it and see. And then maybe if we want to do testing, we can do that. Like whatever you want to do, you know, we'll find a referral for that. Mm-hmm. And I hope that other counselors can do the same kind of thing with dissociation, right? Of evaluating dissociation and seeing, is that a symptom? Is that something that like I can treat and I can work with? Or is it, you know, a dissociative disorder like DID or DPDR or something where I do need to make a referral. Like that's kind of my hope for just anybody listening. Mm-hmm. And then those who do really want to work with trauma, you're going to have to know when am I maybe looking at DID because it's going to overlap a lot. Also too, I would say if you work with in hospital settings or addictions, you tend to have a lot of overlap there as well. So just to be open to it and to know that it's not rare, like people think, and like I said, we'll get into myths, but it's something that happens when there's severe abuse and neglect in childhood, right? Mm-hmm. This isn't something that develops when you're an adult. It develops when you're a child. Now, it can kind of show up or you realize it as an adult.
Right.
That's often when I get clients is they're like, what is happening to me? And they're like really freaked out and they're scared, right? Because they don't know what's going on. And
right.
Sometimes they're like, well, I've always kind of heard this a little bit, you know, and like there's pieces that they can go back and look back and kind of put together. But it's been there since childhood because it doesn't just develop later. It's a protective feature. So you can keep developing in spite of your surroundings, in spite of abuse, in spite of neglect, not getting what you need, not having safety from adults that are supposed to protect you, and then also receiving harm. Your brain and your body is built to like keep going, to keep growing, to grow up in spite of all of this and develop, you know, emotionally, cognitively, relationally, physically, all this stuff. And you do it. And sometimes you do it with the help of dissociating. And that can be to a little degree or a lot degree, right? It can vary. And so I think it's just very important too that people know this. Again, it's real. It's not as rare as you think. It's not in everybody who's experienced trauma, but it's not, I remember being told when I was first going through my master's program, I was going through my trauma class and I was working at a local mental health authority and I had one client that had been in foster care. It wasn't adults. And the mom was present and was like meeting with me as the caseworker and was like, I really think that, you know, she's got DID. And I was like, I don't know. Like, you know, and I was like, I'm a student. I have no idea, you know, and I'm just a caseworker. I'll talk to the doctor about it. So after their doctor's appointment, I talked to the psychiatrist and psychiatrist is like, no, like DID, it's so rare. You're never going to see it in your career. And I was like, okay. And I just like accepted it because I was like, psychiatrist, they know more than me. And like, I didn't know any different. And I look back on that client all the time. And I'm like, I really think that they were right. That mom was right about that situation. And I just didn't know. And the medical system there is saying like, nope, it's not going to happen. And I don't think that was malicious. I think that's just how deep these myths are ingrained. And we think it's factual information when the research shows us that that's just not true. Right. We have so much research to back it up. Yes. So I do think it's important that we recognize like a lot of times people can accept, you know, when kids have been abused and things when they're still kids. Well, mm-hmm. those kids grow up, right? And those are the adults that, like, again, I want to work with, but they're not believed by a lot of people. And they've been, you know, some of them have been involved with CPS and, you know, nothing happens. And they could speak up, or maybe they don't, or maybe they're not believed and they need this yes. as an adult. And so I think it's just really important to recognize the connection to childhood abuse and neglect for particularly DID and OSD, mm-hmm. because it doesn't happen otherwise from what we know in the research.
Did you know that you could earn MBCC continuing education credit from this podcast? That's right. Therapeutic Perspective is an improved MBCC CE provider, and we offer a variety of video and pod courses. Open the episode details and click on the link to learn more. Absolutely. I'm nodding along the whole time. I'm like, yes, how many times have we been told this is rare, this isn't real, and yet, you yeah. know, I engage regularly in consultation mm-hmm. because this is the majority of, you know, what I work with. And yep. so, you know, sitting down with another person and looking at the DES or, you know, others, I use the MID a lot, I love, you know, other assessments, and going through them and recognizing, no, this is DID. This is what DID looks like. And this is okay. Mm-hmm. This is a protective response to childhood trauma. This is, yes. I, in session, the way I describe it is a skill that allowed you to survive. And
a skill. Yeah.
Yes, a beautiful, amazing coping skill. Now, what I've been taught, and you, and this may be a myth, so you can dive in there too. Feel free. What I've been taught is that particularly if abuse and neglect is occurring between ages 4 and 6 or 4 and 8, that we're more likely to see dissociative symptoms appear in adulthood, or they may develop awareness of it in adulthood, despite the fact that this is when the skill typically develops.
Yeah, I dug into lots and lots of research on that for my dissertation, because my dissertation was on the adverse experiences in childhood and dissociation. And so we don't really have it pinned down to an age range, right? And you'll mm-hmm. hear that a lot too. People say that about people with borderline personality disorder as well. Like, uh-huh. has to be a myth around that, is it has to be sexual abuse before age 6. You know, like, so yep. so we try to hold on to those things. And I'm sure there's like a study that has kind of found it, but there's not enough body of work saying like it's certain age frames. Mm-hmm. But we do know it's young, right? And mm-hmm. so it's young and it's repeated severe situations. So this can be, you know, physical abuse, sexual abuse. This can also be neglect. This can be intense emotional, psychological harm, where maybe they never do lay a hand on them, but mm-hmm. there's nobody in the house who is safe. And there's so much fear that the brain doesn't know what to do. And there's so much control, right? Mm-hmm. So it's all these abusive things that can happen. There's also impacts of medical trauma. A couple of my DID clients, they had very serious, this was just the start, unfortunately, of like traumatic childhood, very severe medical things. Like, one of them was in a very horrific car accident, was before seatbelts were mm-hmm. a big thing and were required. And so mm-hmm. they got an accident and they flew through the windshield as like a like a 1-year-old or a toddler. Obviously, that's going to impact us, and we don't have cognitive ability and language or anything to understand it. And mm-hmm. so it gets very like stuck. And that's a significant thing. And then another one I had also had like leukemia as a child, mm-hmm. like age 2 or 3, earliest memories, like the ports for chemo in their body and things like that. And then unfortunately, you know, mm-hmm. more kind of came forward where that was a piece of it, right? So it wasn't all of their childhood abuse, but medical stuff does help. Sometimes too, people growing up with autism, whether they are diagnosed or not diagnosed, that mm-hmm. can be a very traumatic thing. And sometimes that's how we end up with an overlap too of mm-hmm. autistic individuals who also end up with DID, and they end up as DID systems. And mm-hmm. that is a thing too. So it's all these experiences, and the younger that they occur, that's mm-hmm. when you don't have any other coping skills, right? You aren't developed enough to learn different things. So you default on what your brain knows how to do. Right. And dissociating is one of those kind of built-in coping mechanisms where it's like, I'm going away, right? Like, if mm-hmm. I can't physically get away and I don't know anything else to do, all I can do is go away mentally and just get through this. Yes. And that's exactly what it does. When you have to use that all the time, mm-hmm. that's how we end up with DID, right?
Yep.
Now, I also like to point out that DID and OSDD, remember, those are kind of a difference in severity, right? Mm-hmm. So DID tends to be very clearly defined parts. OSDD is, it's not as clearly defined, but they're related. Those always come with a complex PTSD diagnosis, mm-hmm. right? So sometimes you have complex PTSD and they do dissociate, but they may not have a full-on dissociative disorder, right?
Right.
But all of those clients that you're working with DID or OSDD, they've got complex trauma. And complex trauma is, there's usually a relational aspect, there's a repetitious aspect of it, and there's a severity aspect of mm-hmm. it. And it's not a one instance in childhood or something kind of hard. It's like repeated, I cannot escape, I cannot find safety at all, and I'm being harmed. Those are things that like really, really indicate that we could have DID during life.
Yeah. And just hearing you, I'm like, yeah, I so relate and I so feel it for the people that I work with. My clients know I refer to them as my people. So I'm like, my people, you know, yeah. So the people that I work with. And mm-hmm. and I almost like I'm hearing you speak and I'm like, ooh, here's some clips that I can share with my people to feel heard and validated, to know it's not just me saying these things. Look, here's other professionals sharing this information. That's important for you to know. You're okay. You're safe. There's not something wrong with you, because I do find a core belief that's commonly held is there's something wrong with me.
Yes.
Yeah.
A lot of the reason that we tend to do that is because mm-hmm. our brains are trying to convince us that we're in control. And so mm-hmm. sometimes we'll take the fault, we'll take the blame, because if I'm in control, if it's my fault, then I can do something. I can fix it. So I want to be able to also share some more kind of like, I call it like red flags for potential DID, right? We can't say like, yes, you absolutely have it from this, but it should set off a red flag for us, right? Is one, give the DES, the dissociative experience scale. That is a very, very helpful tool. If you've done EMDR training, I know that's where I was first introduced to it. There's a lot more information you can get from that tool besides just the scores. You're actually supposed to go over each item and ask for an example that they score over 30%. And so a lot of times, I don't know, they didn't teach that in my EMDR training. I kind of learned that later. And that's how you get so much information from them. And you can differentiate what their score means, right? So I've had clients that score very high, and then I go through it with them and I'm like, I actually think you might have ADHD. I don't really think it's this anymore. Like, yes, there's some trauma, but this is all related to other things. And then so we kind of go down a different path, right? Mm-hmm. But just the number wouldn't have directed me. It might have been like DID, right? And so mm-hmm. remember that the number doesn't equate to diagnosis. But giving the DES is a huge, huge wealth of information. Some things that are going to be red flags is also going to be chronic trauma in childhood, okay? Before like, for age 10, typically, you know, just like when we're young, not that things can't have happened in teenage years, because that also counts and affects us, right? Mm-hmm. But again, the younger that it occurs, the more likely we are to develop a DID or OSDD. If they have a high number of psychiatric hospitalizations or ER visits, okay, that can be a sign here, because they're, you know, there's some things going on, whether it's panic, it's anxiety, I think I'm having a heart attack, or it's self-harm, it's substance abusing, be lots of things that like they just end up in the medical system a lot. Mm-hmm. Unexplained somatic symptoms. So a lot of people may have heard of pseudo seizures. They're not actually fake seizures. We need a better name for that, but that's what the medical community calls them. But I've watched someone have one of these where it looks 1,000% like a regular seizure, 1,000%. But this client was continuing to have them and actually was hospitalized when one occurred and was hooked up to the machines, and there's no brain seizure.
Wow.
So the brain is not having a seizure, but the body is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very somatic, we've called it like conversion symptoms, right? There's conversion symptom disorder, mm-hmm. things like that. These are very common, or just unexplained, disconnection from the body, or pains, different things that like they can't find a medical reason for. Often tends to be related to dissociation and trauma, memory issues, big complaints about their memory. I have a client who always says, you know, Mom, my memory is Swiss cheese. And it's very true though. Like that's how it sounds. And sometimes they'll be able to tell you like in detail about, you know, I don't know, their high school graduation story. And then the next time they're like, I don't know if I graduated high school. Right.
Yes.
And it will slip. And so what we have to be careful of is labeling them as like lying or manipulative or things like that, because truly they can very much just be in a completely different state of themselves where they don't remember this. They don't, they don't know. They might have a memory of, oh, I remember we talked about that, but like, I don't know. And so those kind of things are, again, red flags, disconnection, not feeling the body, or not feeling like they're real. That's a very, very common complaint that you'll hear. Sometimes they will tell you about hearing voices internally. Most of the time you have to ask for that, because so much across pop culture, movies and all sorts of stuff, if you say you hear voices, they're terrified. I'm going to get thrown in a padded room, right?
Yes.
And that's not what should happen. That's not what has to happen at all. There's nothing wrong with you for hearing those, whether they're, you know, psychotic voices or they're dissociative voices. Like that just is, and let's treat it. Let's work with it. But people are scared to disclose it. So you have to ask about it. Missing time for blank spells, trances. Sometimes you'll see that in a session where they'll just kind of like stare off for a while. You might have to be like, hey, where'd you go? Or what's going on? And sometimes they notice, sometimes they don't. And then asking them like, does that happen a lot? Do you know if it happens a lot? Do other people tell you it happens? Do you miss time? A lot of the time, my DID clients will be like, oh yeah, I lose time all the time. And you're like, no. Tell me more. What do you mean? And they'll be like, sometimes I go to, you know, I take a nap on a Tuesday and I wake up and it's Friday and all of a sudden I'm at work. And it's like they wake up doing things, right? Because those states internally are like shifting, those self states. And they miss dates, you know, because those dissociative walls between parts of their personality system are not, they're so thick, they're not able to communicate with each other. And so it's like, I'm here and then I'm not here. And then suddenly I'm here again. And that can be very distressing and confusing, right?
Yes.
So those are kind of standout things. And then I would also mention suicidality or self-harm behaviors, again, in themselves are not a sign of DID, but with everything else kind of go together. And they often have been misdiagnosed as a borderline personality disorder. They'll end up with schizophrenia diagnoses as well, sometimes bipolar. Very often, they'll end up with pseudo seizures, quote unquote, or somatic disorders, conversion disorder, things like that. And those are all signs of like, maybe there's something else here.
Yep, definitely. And I'm curious about this one. And again, take your time to think about it. But you were speaking and it occurred to me, you know, thinking about medical trauma, but also just their experience with the medical system, because for me, I find that very frustrating. And it's to the point where I'm like, I want to make a workshop just so I can give it to medical providers so that my people can have a positive medical interaction. I'm curious if you've seen that, you know, what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah. So one, I want to just point out, like, different studies have a few different numbers, but roughly between 7 and 8 years is how long it takes for these clients to get an appropriate diagnosis. They're in and out of the medical system. This isn't just them sitting at home thinking about it. This is since they engage with the medical system, takes 7 to 8 years, okay, to get them diagnosed, which delays treatment, delays all this stuff, right? So like, that's a big issue. They are often more often going to ERs, psych hospitals, things like that, where there's very acute care and or it's just medical, not psychiatric focus. There's so many different barriers there. And like you said, just a lack of education on the medical professional side. Like they obviously have to know lots of medical stuff that, you know, I don't have to know. But this is something else that could be really helpful in terms of trauma-informed care in general. It's been really bad for most of my clients in terms of their interactions with medical system, even just with their own like primary care doctors or psychiatrists. So much so often my clients are very afraid of getting on medication because they've had such bad experiences. And the thing is there's no medication to treat dissociation. So a lot of the times psychiatrists are like, whatever, you know, they don't even know what to do with it, but they can treat depression and anxiety for them. And sometimes mood stabilizers are also helpful. And so I will go to my client and I'll just be like, hey, you know, if you're open to it, like, let's just kind of explore the conversation, because I think the depression is like really big. And like, you know, I'm kind of concerned and I'm wondering if medication is an option. And if they're not into it, I don't push them. But the ones that are, I tell them, hey, you and I have talked about DID is a diagnosis or OSCD is a diagnosis. Mm-hmm. You don't necessarily have to tell your doctor that. And the reason I tell them that is for their own protection against the stigma that exists. And I hate mm-hmm. that, but I think that this is the safest way that I can get them to get what they need, essentially. Yes. And so I say, you go in there and you describe your symptoms. And I always offer to write a letter and just say, hey, I've been seeing this client this long and please evaluate for these symptoms. I think you can help things. And that usually helps give them some credibility and they're a little less stressed when they can take that with them. And the doctors, they know how to treat, you know, depression and anxiety, and they can do that. And like, it can really, really help these clients, but they can't do anything to make the dissociation go away. And if they come in with that diagnosis, sometimes that stigma is just so strong and so enculturated that they don't get treated for it. And it becomes a big issue.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Yes. I feel you. And I even, when you were talking, I was like, yes, I do the same thing. But yeah. I mean, we have a conversation. Yep. There's a lot of time spent around preparing, and I write a letter because I want them to get the care that they need. And we understand that some of these other diagnoses do come with a lot of stigma associated with them. And unfortunately, entering a space where we, you know, may not be trained in trauma or understand what these diagnoses mean will inhibit their ability to get the care that they need. Yeah.
Exactly. It's this means to an end kind of thing with our healthcare system, which I think we can all acknowledge is not great. And we have to navigate within it and make it work for our clients as best we can. I've also been in the position where I had a client was one of my pro bono clients and was connected to like a local mental health authority where like you still had to have one of the big three diagnoses, mm-hmm. major depression, bipolar, or schizophrenia, to receive like the free psychiatric care and case management. And then also like they would get your medications. She was connected with them and they had her diagnosed with schizophrenia. And we had many conversations about like, that's not what's going on. We're in agreement. And I said, let's just let them call it that so that you can get the medication that helps. They weren't even giving her antipsychotics, which I thought was kind of funny. if you have schizophrenia, you need those, you know?
Yes, you do.
It's your symptoms. And so I was like, okay. But I was like, look, if that's the special word that we need to get you, you know, free medication, I think that's what we need to do. And like, as long as you're okay with it, like, I don't care. And she's like, cool, okay. But you give them permission sometimes where, you know, they're not trying to lie or be manipulative, but like, you know, you almost have to tell like, hey, it's okay. Let's just let it be because you need to get what you need, you know, and it's a very awkward position, but I think it's one way that we can help advocate for our clients is letting them know, hey, it's okay. It's okay to do that. You have to.
Right. No, it's not. And it's a system, you know, it's a systemic issue and they need the help. And, you know, it's not like, I mean, this is another person's diagnosis. You have no control over it anyways. And, you know, they're getting help based on someone else's diagnosis and they need that help. Yeah. Oh, I'm so with you. Yes. So you mentioned that you may see some dissociative symptoms with ADHD or OCD, possibly even with other diagnoses. Do you want to talk more about that?
Yeah. Right. Like I mentioned, of dissociation being that symptom. When it's a symptom, it can be present in a lot of things. And I will say your DSM does not list dissociation as a lot of these, but the research does. So that's one thing too. Our manuals are very outdated. And even when in 2013, when it came out, it was outdated in terms of research with particularly dissociation. So ADHD is a common one and OCD is also a common one that we see this with getting very absorbed, right? When I talk about absorption as a type of dissociation, I'm taking that from the DES, right? So the DES measures imaginative absorption. I just usually call it absorption, depersonalization, derealization, and amnesia. So those tend to be kind of like three ways we can kind of think about categories of dissociation as symptoms. And you see high levels of absorption with ADHD and OCD because they're getting sucked into those thoughts, right? Or they're getting hyper-focused on a certain thing. Or the compulsions and you know, the thoughts, things like that, that they kind of get stuck on. Some other ones might be like during mania for bipolar. There's a lot of dissociation that kind of goes on there. They're disconnected a bit from reality. We get a lot more depersonalization, derealization. And there can be some amnesia. Sometimes people don't really remember like what they've done or said or anything when they've been in a manic state because it just feels very dreamlike and kind of, you know, whimsical and separate from you. It just feels very unreal. that's a great way to kind of describe some of this dissociation in those other disorders. We also see it in eating disorders. Mm-hmm. Eating disorders are, you know, research shows is kind of very closely related to OCD and kind of, you know, things like that as well with the compulsions and the thoughts and stuff and the behaviors. So we see the same kind of thing where they can completely dissociate and kind of do the getting sucked into this thought of, you know, I have to look this way or I can't eat this thing or this is going to happen and mm-hmm. getting very high levels of anxiety with that as well. So the dissociation and anxiety can kind of work together, unfortunately, to lead to a lot of those issues within those disorders. And then, of course, we do see it in PTSD, right? We did get a PTSD dissociative subtype in the DSM-5 that was brand new. So we do get that a little bit, but most of the time you're not going to see dissociation as a symptom list in your DSM.
That's helpful to know. And just for, you know, the clinicians that specialize in other areas can use this also to start assessing for, is dissociation happening?
Right.
What am I seeing with this client? And mm-hmm. and also very interesting when you talk about, for instance, with OCD or eating disorders, sort of facilitates things because of the ability to disconnect. Very interesting.
Yes, the disconnection. Yeah.
So talk me through what your process is with a new client. You know, whether they come in with an existing diagnosis or this is your first time working with them and maybe they have been, like we talked about earlier, through a few providers and not gotten the correct diagnosis thus far. You know, what does that intake look like? And are there any questionnaires or assessments that you frequently utilize?
Yes. So my marketing, my ideal clients are, you know, trauma or dissociative clients, you know, mm-hmm. single incident PTSD when that happens. Not as common, I think, complex trauma I get a lot. And then, of course, my dissociative disorders. So it's already kind of like out there all over my advertising and stuff about me. So I tend to kind of get those clients. My intake process is very much, I am assuming everyone is probably dissociating some because of what I work with. And so mm-hmm. I always give the DES at the very beginning. I use Simple Practice, so it's real easy. I can just send it. It's all built in, which is super nice. Yep. I also use the ACE-Q, so the Adverse Childhood Experience Questionnaire. This is just a simple 10-question yes-no assessment. So I don't get like detailed information, but it helps me ask about it. It covers abuse and neglect and then household dysfunction. So it asks mm-hmm. questions about, you know, physical abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse, but then it also asks, you know, was there anybody in your house with mental illness or drug abuse, or was a family member incarcerated, you know, divorced parents, like, you know, just things that were changing in the household. It does not cover medical trauma. I always ask about that. And it doesn't cover religious trauma, racial trauma, poverty, things like that. So there's definitely things missing, but it's a good start. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the research has used this as a tool. I know that was one I used in my dissertation as well. And like, because it's yes, no, it's a little bit easier to kind of work with. But there are different areas of trauma and that can have been occurring since they were very young children. And might still be occurring, you know, again, like some of the sometimes medical trauma, racial trauma, poverty, you know, things like that. Gender and sex issues as well. Right. So there's a lot of things that aren't there, but it gives me a good jumping off point, essentially. So I always include that there as well. And those are my two that I start with from the get-go with absolutely everybody. And then when I am doing my first session with them, I really, sometimes it takes a session or two to kind of go through all of those items that they score over 30% on the DES. Mm-hmm. I explain it to them and kind of like why I'm doing this, why I'm looking at this. And that's how you can kind of start the process towards the DID diagnosis if it's there. And it may not come up then. It might be a while. I worked with a client for over a year before I did finish my EMDR training and I gave the DES because I was like, I'm going to do EMDR with this client. And then I was like, wait a second. No, I'm not. They're very dissociative. And I was like, at the time I was starting to learn, this was like very early on. And I was starting to learn more about it. And I was like, oh, I think maybe this is one. And mm-hmm. it took us like probably 2 years of assessment and exploration before I was really like, oh, I am on the path to DID. Yes. And that was where we ended up landing. But those cases DID is harder to identify. And mm-hmm. so you're not necessarily going to get it from an intake or from a first session or so. So you're really just kind of looking for broad potential red flags, right? Mm-hmm. In the very beginning. And then just as you work with somebody, you kind of see, do more of those red flags I discussed earlier, do those pop up? Sometimes too, you do a DS at the very beginning and then you do one a little bit later and they're very different. You know, so you have to kind of, again, use your clinical judgment here too. You mentioned earlier, like the MID. The MID is multidimensional inventory of dissociation. And then there's also the DDIS, the dissociative disorder interview schedule, and the SCID-D, which recently, just now, was updated to DSM-5. Those are diagnostic assessments, right? The SCID-D is considered a gold standard, but it requires a lot of training, very expensive to kind of go through. DDIS is free. MID, I believe you just have to be licensed, and you know, but they have training available for both of those.
Really good ones.
Yes. Yeah. The MID training is great. With Michael Coy and Jennifer Madieri, they're wonderful. And they offer, you know, pre-recorded and all sorts of stuff with that. And then Dr. Colin Ross does the DDIS, and there's training available online for that one too. And if you're thinking maybe this is a client, I don't do those assessments immediately. I don't do my intake. Right. Suspected and then immediately do that. It's a bit overwhelming unless I have a client coming to me saying, I think I might have DID, like what's going on, you know, and then I'm like, okay, let's step through the process together. Like we can figure this out. Then I might do it a little earlier, but I usually wait a while because I need to get a feel for the client and really see is that really, you know, a direction that I feel like we might need to explore. Unless the client is directly wanting to, then I go with that.
Right. Absolutely. And I feel like, for instance, the MID, since that's the one I use frequently, it's for the listeners who don't use it, if you're using the long one, it's very long. I'm trying to remember, I want to say 217 questions, but that's off the top of my head. So I could be wrong. You know, and it can, especially with, you know, clients that may have, whether it's DID or any, you know, dissociation present,
right?
It actually can take longer. And that, at least in my experience. Yes. And so I find that establishing safety, rapport, and, you know, also letting them know what the purpose is of doing this before I jump into something like the MID, at least for me, works really well. Yes. I know other clinicians that they can get it done. I want to say someone mentioned to me like in 20 or 30 minutes, and I was like, wow, that's awesome. Wow. Good for you. Clearly I cannot. But I do find, like you're saying, the DS is a great beginning point. I do use ACEs as well. But then also using the MID a little later when we feel more comfortable and we're ready and we feel like that's what's needed or whatever assessment.
And that's the hard part about those diagnostic ones is they're pretty long. You know, I can't remember off the top of my head SCID-D, but it's at least over 100. And then the DDIS is, I think, 132. And it's DDIS, at least I think it's yes, no, versus some of the other ones are a little bit different. And so it takes more time. But even with like, yes, no, I mean, depending on how dissociative and how triggered your client is by the questions, you know,
yes,
I've done it with a client where like she did pretty good. And, you know, we did, I usually schedule an hour and a half for it. I think it says you can do it in 60 minutes. I'm like, I don't know how people do that. So I always plan an hour and a half. And then I had another client that I did it with and just asking, you know, were you sexually abused? There's some specific questions about abuse and just asking that, it was so triggering. And that's where telehealth was in my favor because they were there at their home and I was able to say, okay, let's stop, you know, I'm on your phone. Take me down to the kitchen. We're going to go to the kitchen. We're going to make some tea. We're going to, you know, we're going to just take a minute. And I could kind of guide them through coping skills that I knew already because I already knew the client that were like helpful for them to self-soothe so that then we could get back to it. But I also gave the option of like, do you want to stop here and do it next week? And, you know, they're like, no, I want to get through it. And I was like, okay. And it was rough. We had to do aftercare and kind of plan for that. Because just the assessment can be very, very triggering for them. So I think that's an important thing to think about, again, in choosing your timing with a diagnostic assessment, right? The DES, it's not near as triggering as that. It's more about those day-to-day experiences. But because those other ones ask specifics about abuse history, sometimes it's too much. So I think that's important for everyone to be aware of.
Yeah, I would completely agree. And you mentioned already, you know, taking a break with telehealth and letting them go make tea. Do you have anything else that you use frequently or that you suggest?
Yeah. So this was something I stumbled on by accident with my very first client. I was still doing in-person services. This was like in 2016 or 17. And when I started working with that client, like I kind of ended up, it was a very chaotic time in her life. And so I ended up kind of getting a different part. And I'll take a little segue here. When you're talking about dissociative people, sometimes you hear the language of alters. Sometimes you hear the language of parts. I've been saying states or states of self. States of personality, like all of those are valid. They're just kind of a little bit from different theories. You go with whatever your client wants to call it. In the community for DID folks, you know, they tend to prefer more like, you know, multiple or being a DID system, things like that versus like me, I would be like a singlet. So it's a little bit different language, but you don't see that as much in the research, but you hear it from the community. And I think that's very important to kind of recognize too.
Yes.
So I just wanted to sidebar there real quick.
That's helpful.
But basically one of her parts came through. We were going through something about, there was a question about abuse, and I kind of watched all of her facial muscles soften and her eyes get real big. And like, she kind of went nonverbal. It was, I mean, I had a child part with me, but I, again, at that time, I'm like, I didn't quite know what I was doing.
Hey, thanks so much for joining us today. Remember, this is just part one of a two-part episode. Hop on over to episode 59 to keep on listening. Also, if you haven't checked out our free clinician community, search Therapeutic Perspective Community on Facebook or follow us on Instagram. We're there under Therapeutic Perspective _ podcast. Hope to see you there. Well, everyone, that's it for today. We're glad you joined us. And if you like this episode, click subscribe and leave a review. Also, check out our free clinician community on Facebook. Just search for Therapeutic Perspective Community. I hope to see you there and back here again in a few weeks for our next episode. Thanks for listening and see you then.